Learn to code, build apps, inspire the next generation.
Welcome to the Swift App School podcast, where we are empowering the next generation of app developers.
I'm Charles Long, co-founder of Swift App School.
And I'm Bob Williams, co-founder of Swift App School.
All right, welcome to episode 6 of the Swift App School podcast. Today, we're going to discuss, in light of Black History Month, 7 apps created by Black developers. We're also going to talk about implementing the photo gallery and scrolling ability in our previous app that we developed for an educational institution. We're also going to talk about Facebook's blaming Apple for major market cap loss. And then we're going to finalize with something cool as usual. All right, Bob, how are you doing today?
Doing pretty good. I wanted to start the episode just mentioning our app camp that we do every year for ages 13 to 18. We like to teach teenagers kind of the basics of iOS development. We did a virtual camp in 2020, but did an in-person in 2021. And then this year, 2022, this summer, July the 11th through the 15th here in Asheville, North Carolina, we're going to have another app camp. So if you know any teenagers in the area who would be interested in a day camp experience where they just learn all things iOS, this is a great opportunity for them to be exposed to this at an early age. And a lot of our former students are now teacher assistants, and they come out and help out every year and are also helping us build some tutorials right now, which we've mentioned before. But it's an exciting time to see how quickly these students pick it up.
Thanks, Bob. So we're going to start out our podcast today talking about Black developers, and obviously being a Black developer myself, thought it was interesting. I found this article that Code Academy put out, and the title of that article is 7 Apps Created by Black Developers Inspired by the Black Community. Their article starts out talking about the first app, which is We Read Too. And this app is developed by Kaya Thomas. And Kaya used to be an employee at Calm. What do you call Calm? It's a meditation app.
It's the app that helps you sleep at night. It's the app that helps you meditate. I actually use it every day now with my wife. We meditate in the mornings and are using Calm app, which is awesome. I just discovered it's on Apple TV now. They just released the tvOS version. It has some hiccups, but it's still nice to have it on the TV. I think the hiccups are due to tvOS just being limited, is my guess, because the Calm app is awesome.
So Kaya Thomas wanted to make it easier for young people to find books written by people of color and featuring main characters and authors who look like her. So she built We Read Too, a mobile database with hundreds of picture, chapter, middle grade, and young adult books. Thomas has lots of professional experience developing apps. She worked as an iOS engineer at Calm and Slack and has a degree in computer science from Dartmouth. But she clearly remembers the aha moment when the power of coding clicked. Once I realized that anyone can create an app, it was a huge moment for me to understand that I can build real things that people can use and put it out for them to be able to access, she told Apple.
Yeah, it looks really cool. Yeah, I like the way it's set up and the design looks really nice. I was thinking about it. You were talking about these 7 apps. I was thinking about your laptop. You probably have about 35 apps sitting there that you've worked on that you haven't ever published to the App Store.
Oh yeah.
You know.
At some point, I need to finish those. You're right.
I'm the same way. I've got a lot of projects I've started but never finished. So. I think a lot of developers are like that, where you kind of get started on something. You're like, oh, I want to finish this. And then you get caught up in something else. So easy to do. But yeah, this one looks really nice. I think it's nice that she's highlighting a lot of the African-American authors out there.
It also says that there are more than 900 titles on We Read Too. And if there's one missing, you can suggest it through the app. So that's pretty cool.
That is nice. It's interactive too. Cool.
Second app, Eat Okra.
Yeah, I like the name.
Very clever. In charge of picking the next restaurant for date night, consider checking Eat Okra, a database for Black-owned restaurants, cafes, food trucks, and eateries around the country. The app Eat Okra was founded by Anthony and Janique Edwards, a couple who wanted to discover Black-owned eateries in their own neighborhood in Brooklyn. Edwards worked as a software developer and always wanted to build his own app. But most importantly, I wanted to gain new skills for the next development job down the road, Edwards told Travel Noir in June. So what's better than building a product that people are using? Said it took Edwards 14 months to build the app and launch it. Word spread quickly. In 2020, as people prioritized shopping at Black-owned businesses in the months following the death of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter protests, Eat Okra saw a 4,000% spike in users, the founders told MarketWatch. The app now has more than 400,000 users. Wow.
That's really cool.
Next app, speaking of meditation, Liberate Black Meditation app. Listening to a guided meditation through an app is one of the easiest ways to learn how to meditate, but finding a platform or an instructor that fits your specific goals and vibe can be challenging. That's why Julio Rivera created Liberate, a meditation app led by BIPOC teachers and designed for the Black experience. Rivera, who identifies as Black and Latinx, was a computer programmer working at Priceline.com when he decided to expand on his knowledge and learn to build apps. Rivera says he self-taught himself how to build iPhone apps and says it was pretty straightforward.
You know, I'm seeing a theme in some of these apps that were created. A lot of them were, some of them were, you know, self-taught. Some of them have a education background. But I do notice that, you know, whenever you're building your own project, it's the same thing at App Camp when we have our students there and they're like, start building a project. They start to feel motivated, you know, and they start to see, wow, I can do this too. And it really does open up a new world to them. So I think this is cool to see so many new developers out there now.
This next app is pretty cool. Goal Setter. It says most 8-year-olds don't ask their parents for investment accounts for their birthdays, but that's exactly what Tanya Van Court's daughter wanted for her 9th birthday. The unconventional gift inspired Van Court to start Goal Setter, an app for kids that gamifies financial literacy. This is pretty cool.
That is cool.
In that moment, I knew that if I could get every Black child to say that, I could change the world for our community. Van Court, who was formerly an exec at Nickelodeon, told BET. As a Black woman in fintech, Van Court feels uniquely positioned to help educate the next generation of savers and ultimately close the racial wealth gap that persists between Black and white people in America. Never before in the history of America has there been a Black-owned tech and financial education company that is targeted at our children, Van Court told Afrotech. And there's a feature on the app called Learn Before You Burn, which freezes a kid's debit card until they pass a fun and meme-heavy financial literacy quiz each week.
Oh, that's cool. I like that. I need my daughter to get that one.
No, that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Next one, Kickstroid. If you're a sneakerhead who's constantly checking your social feeds for the next trends and shoe news, take note. Kickstroy is a new app that uses artificial intelligence to help sneaker fans track shoe prices on the resale market, learn about sneaker culture, and follow favorite brands. David Alston and Nico Adams, friends and self-proclaimed sneakerheads, built the app as students at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. To the co-founders, the app's mission goes deeper than their interest in fashion. Sneaker culture is so rooted in Black culture and Black vision. Alston, who has a computer science background, told Input Mag, yet a lot of people on the technical side of the sneaker industry don't look like us. So, Kickstroy, I'm not a big sneakerhead, but I know people who are definitely into, like, they buy sneakers every paycheck.
I was in the 7th and 8th grade when I wanted Air Jordans and my parents wouldn't get them for me.
I understand. I was lucky to get like some, what do you call those old shoes? What did we have when I was younger?
I always got the high top Nikes, but I never got the Air Jordans that I wanted.
Yeah, I had the Kmart specials. That's what it was.
Okay.
The kind that rip when you're playing basketball. So. Yeah, I definitely wasn't a sneakerhead, but I can see this app being really, really popular, you know, with a lot of the teens now.
Oh, yeah.
Next app, Official Black Wall Street. Mandy Bowman used to keep a spreadsheet with a running list of Black-owned businesses. Then she turned the directory into an app called Official Black Wall Street. The idea for the website came first, but I really wanted to get to the app. Bowman, who worked in marketing and social media prior to starting Official Black Wall Street, told Essence, I wanted to make the search as easy as possible. to the point where we can literally let people know, okay, there's a business next to you now that you should walk into. Today, thousands of Black-owned businesses around the country, plus Canada, the Caribbean, United Kingdom, are listed on the app. Whether you're looking for a gym or a coffee shop to try or need to find a doula or insurance agent, having an official Black Wall Street on hand makes it easier to buy Black. The next app is Swivel. Longtime friends Jennifer Lambert and Jihan Thompson co-founded Swivel in 2016 after struggling to find local hair salons and stylists who specialize in working with textured hair. The app allows you to read reviews, book appointments, and pay for services directly through the app interface. Neither one of us knew how to code when we started, so that was our biggest initial technical hurdle, Thomas, a former magazine editor, told Elle. Building an app was a big challenge. Lambert, who was a lawyer prior to Swivel, said in the Elle interview, but it's been extremely rewarding to see what we're capable of figuring out on our own. So I agree. A lot of these are people that are just starting out with coding. Like, they don't have a lot of experience. They have something that they're generally interested in and passionate about. And they realize, okay, I need to develop an app in order to, you know, fulfill this mission.
Yeah.
And they're, I think having that passion to build something is what it takes, because when it gets difficult to develop, as you know,
yeah,
that's when that passion for that project you're working on really kicks in. And that's the only thing that can really take you through finishing the project.
Agreed.
So going back to a point that we talked about in the past, you know, when you were going to the conferences, you can kind of reiterate what you saw going to WWDC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we in 2010, the very first year we went to the Apple conference, well, we weren't able to see Steve Jobs. That's another story. we were locked out of the keynote because we got there too late. We didn't realize people were standing in line like hours and hours before WWDC. But then, like, once we got into the sessions and we're in, you know, and then you're going to the labs and I'm looking around and I'm like, wow, I see some international folks, but I don't see a lot of African Americans. I mean, all these people, they're mainly white males. Like, that was the majority of the people there. And I just remember thinking, wow, where are Charles's people? I mean, they're just not there. And it just seemed odd to me that, because we had been to the Adobe conferences before and they were a lot more diverse. So it just seemed strange. And I'm glad that now you've got, you know, sites that are devoted to Black developers and inspiring, you know, the Black community, because that's what it's all about. And that's why we're doing what we're doing, is we're trying to, you know, empower teenagers and teenagers from, you know, underserved communities to learn how to code and empower them to do something great. So that's what it's all about. We want to give back, because we've been very fortunate to have been able to, you know, sit down with Apple developers and sit down in the labs for years and years and figure all this stuff out when there weren't a lot of resources other than books. There were a few tutorials online other than Stanford. That was about when we started. That was it. Was the Stanford lecture series, which is above everybody's head at first. you're starting to see more and more stories of people who are not traditional coders, who do not have computer science backgrounds, but now they've created an app. And it's because they've found tutorials that are online. They've discovered Swift App School and other, you know, resources like that. So that's what we want to do, is break down that barrier.
I agree. And I don't believe that what you saw in those early conferences was because, you know, African-Americans aren't intelligent enough to develop apps or anything. I think a lot of it's about exposure, not just in computer science, but a lot of different areas and a lot of disciplines that there are, you know, I think it's great we're getting back, because it gives all nationalities and opportunity, not just the African-American community, but all teenagers an opportunity to be exposed to something that traditionally has sort of a stigma or maybe a stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
out. And I think that's what drives a lot of people away. It's like, well, I don't want to be a programmer. That's a nerd. And they have a picture in their mind about what it is.
I mean, it was also very male dominated too. I mean, it's been male dominated for years and years and years. And I think that's the other thing that we're trying to break that down, because, I mean, we both have daughters who are interested in coding and I don't want them to feel like, you know, to see those stereotypes and then feel like they're less of a developer than anybody else, or they can be, you know, I want them to dream big as well. So that's part of it.
Very well said.
Okay, so for the iOS Mac development, I guess we're going to go back to the app that we've created back in 2013. We keep going back to it, but it was so big. It was so massive. There's so many lessons that we learned along the way. And one of the big ones was scrolling, because we had custom scrolling all across this app. And we weren't just doing web views and things like that. We were actually creating a custom design that had never really been done the way we implemented it before on both the iPad and the iPhone. At the time, I think there was an iPad mini, and then there was the regular iPhone, but there weren't a lot of different versions of the iPhone at that point. So you didn't have the size classes and things like that came later. It was just constraints, which we never really felt competent to teach because there's so many different, it's just kind of like a mystery science that you just have to figure out by doing. But yeah, scrolling was a big thing. And we found a video of the app that we did a long time ago. And so, because I had forgotten what it looks like, but you know, we had a series of buttons with a slideshow kind of behind the buttons that was always going when you open the app. And then we had a scroll view for a news section. We had a multimedia section that when you click on that, it would go to the multimedia section and it would slide. It would change from the slideshow that you're seeing to a scroll view that it would just, we had what, it was basically an array of four views that we had in the scroll view. And it would just slide to that. So if you clicked calendars, it would slide to the calendar section. If it's clicked publications, it would slide to that publications view. And if you clicked on virtual tour, it would slide to that. Multimedia, same thing. So that was kind of cool, because I don't think we weren't really inspired by any apps out there. That's what we visualized. And we just, and sometimes it's harder to do that, because you visualize something, you say, here's how I want it to work. And then you have to figure out, okay, how are we going to implement this? Because, I mean, we didn't have a model. There wasn't anything that Apple had built for us that was just like, okay, we just, you know, fire off these three lines of code and now it works. We had to build it from the ground up.
Yeah, I think we did a lot of like timers, so we could the slideshow to automatically advance through the slides or something like that, if I'm
remember. I think so. And then we also, like, when you clicked one of the buttons, so there's like a red button, a green button, and orange and blue. And so when you click one, so say you click on virtual tour, which is a green button, it was just a little green rectangle, but it would just, there was a little animation that kicked in. There was a little page flip effect. And I remember I did that page flip animation in Illustrator and then exported it. And maybe, I don't know if I think maybe we put it back into After Effects. I'm not sure, but somehow we exported into just individual JPEG files, I believe.
Like sort of a flipbook style. Like you just created the individual pictures in Illustrator, and then we just flipped them. We ran a series of photos, so it looked like an animated, like a smooth animation of a curl of a page on every button.
I think originally there were like 150 photos, and then we pared it down to like 10 photos or something, you know, so it still had the animation effect, but it wouldn't have to go through a very long array of photos. I mean, so.
Yeah. So that button is what you use to actually advance the scroll view, I believe.
Yeah,
that was cool.
Anyway, so scroll view was all over this app. And I think you kind of, in a way, had to rewrite scroll view just to make it work the way you wanted to, or eventually.
Yeah, I had to highly customize it.
And then we had the photo gallery, which is really interesting, because I think we had several versions of the photo gallery. That was kind of the last piece that I remember we finally finished, because it was complicated and there were a lot of memory issues. It would slow down, like as you would add more than 10 photos, it would start to slow down. You know, I think we had to implement some complicated like dispatch async calls so that it wasn't all on the main thread. This is getting pretty down in the weeds now, but yeah, there were some complicated things we had to implement that we didn't really fully understand at the time. And there were limitations that caused us to kind of think outside of the box and create a custom design.
I was trying to figure out if you've got 500 images and you want to load them all in the photo gallery, your iPad or iPhone can't load them all at one time. And I had seen a video, you know, previously with, I believe it was Eliza Block and what's his name? Josh?
Josh. Yeah.
Forgot his last name. Josh Block were always the scroll view people.
He's kind of the Swift UI guy now though, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember watching videos about how you have to control the number of pictures that are being downloaded at a time. And you had to basically offload some of that stuff once it was off screen. So I was having a struggle point with that. So I decided, okay, let's just think outside the box so we can get this running. Let's make a scroll view that basically only has 10 images. And once those 10 images are gone, then it would just unload the 10 images out of memory and load the next 10. But I didn't want it to look obvious. I wanted it to feel like it was something we did deliberately. So basically, I took the idea from, I think, from being in your office and seeing a stack of photos on your desk. It must have been, because I don't know what I was inspired by, but I think seeing like a spread of photos laying on top of a desk.
That sounds right, because my desk is always pretty messy. So.
But yeah, I think I saw that one day and I was like, oh, that would be a neat idea. What if I just have 10 photos that just look like they're stacked on top of each other and you can just swipe each one off? And then when you get to the 10th one, it would just be a blank canvas and reload the next 10. And it actually was pretty cool. That worked. But even still, I got to like 100 images and it seemed like it was still slowing down. I was in a lot of trouble. And so we went to WWDC. This is probably 2012, because yeah. I think 2010 was the first year we were overwhelmed when we went to the conference. I think 2011 is when we
2011 was ARC, right?
Yeah, we learned how to use ARC and all that, and we'll talk about that another podcast episode. But the next year, I think we had a pretty solid app, and then 2013 we actually completed the entire app. So yeah, it took a long time to finish this app. 2012. We went to the labs to get some help on this project, and we were assigned to Ken Kashinda. And so we sat there. We didn't know who Ken Kashinda was, but they said, yeah, you need to talk to Ken. He can help you with this pretty easily. So he sat down, looked at the code, and he was like, oh, yeah, you guys need a little bit of delegation here. You need to download these in the background using some Grand Central Dispatch. And we're just looking like, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, we knew about threading. I knew about threading from previous programming languages, but all of a sudden, like, he was talking another language and we knew, okay, we need a lot of help. And what I was impressed with is that first he was asking questions like, have you tried this? Have you tried this? Have you tried that? And we were like, no. So he just grabbed my laptop and started writing the whole thing. I'm like amazed. I'm looking at him like,
how are you doing this?
I mean, even now I write code, but I can't just write a person's class for them just off the cuff. I mean, yeah. I was impressed. I didn't know who I was talking to. So we're sitting there, he's writing this code, you know, and I'm like, yeah, these photos, sometimes they come in upside down. And it's weird because I see this mostly in Safari. Like, I don't know what the deal is with Safari. It's just like the images come upside down. And I guess it doesn't read the metadata right and doesn't know how to take, you know, when you're, you know, taking a screenshot on an iPhone, it doesn't know how to handle that. And he stops coding and he just looks at me. He's like, watch it, buddy. I wrote Safari.
Yeah.
I was like, excuse me? He's like, watch it, buddy. I was like, oh, what I mean is like, he's like, oh, no, don't try to back out of it now. Yeah. It was hilarious. And of course, after we got done, he helped us figure out how to write this class. It was amazing. We were able to help, you know, he was able to help us figure out how to write this photo gallery. We looked him up later and sure enough, his name's on the patents. And he actually gave a talk about how he was tasked by Apple to start writing Safari. So I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't believe it. Oh man, but
well, you really insulted the guy.
I think he was, you know, low key joking.
He was joking,
but it was one of those funny stories that we always think about in the conference. It was just hilarious. Well,
he also wrote the keyboard, the virtual keyboard on the iPad and the iPhone too.
True. Yeah, he did.
So he's credited with that. So he's a pretty big figure in iOS development.
Yeah, and I think he'd had a great talk at WWDC. I'll have to look it up about great work. I can't remember.
Maybe we can link it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll link it in the notes because it was a great, inspiring talk for developers. I really gleaned a lot from that because it helped us realize that when you're developing an app, even working at Apple, sometimes they don't know what to do and they have to reach out to other people to get help. And he was pretty open and candid about it in his talk. Like, I didn't know how to build a browser. I didn't know how to build a keyboard. I had to go ask people for help that were at Apple. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the way it works. Just going back to the earlier point that we're not geniuses on our own. We gotta learn from other people. We gotta be exposed to the technologies and spend time experimenting to learn how to develop these apps. And so
we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, as they say.
Yeah, I love that statement because it's so true. But I thought, you know, as we're talking about scroll view, and a lot of people may or may not understand what that is, basically Apple's code that they wrote that allows you to swipe with your finger up and down to scroll through content. You see it a lot in the music players or podcast apps or whatever. You know, it's all over the apps and both iOS and Android, honestly. Like, the scroll view is one of the staples of app development. And then they have
in the Mac world, is it NS scroll? Is that what it's called, or what's it?
At one time it was, I guess.
Yeah, probably back in early days.
And so they have table view and collection view. When you're talking the old user interface design language, which was UIKit, scroll view was basically like a canvas that allowed you to put things on it and you can move left, right, up and down. So if you wanted to build a map, like map uses scroll view underneath the hood at some point, table view does, and so does collection view. Table view is basically your standard. I need a table of information that I can scroll up vertically.
Table view is like what so many iOS developers seems like that's what they learned first. Yep. With table view, it was kind of the classic framework that you need in most apps, or that you would see in most apps. It's interesting that we didn't really learn that first. Like most developers didn't go custom at first, and we kind of went custom in the very beginning, in the early days.
Well, it's probably why it was so difficult for us to understand, because we jumped right in. We're like, okay, we want to have this slideshow thing. Yeah. And I jumped into scroll view and it was overwhelming. And then later, as we got into table view and some of these other things, I realized, oh yeah, if we'd done table view first, it would have been the stepping stone we needed to understand scroll view. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from reading through tons of documentation, watching videos. And you're right. I think that scroll view is probably not the first topic you should learn when you're learning iOS development. Definitely in UIKit, you should learn table view first.
Yeah. And then, you know, now, I mean, you don't necessarily even start with table view. I mean, it's almost obsolete at this point, because I would say just start with Swift UI and don't even learn the UI kit right now. You can always go back and learn that later. But I do remember, you know, after table view, I remember going into collection view for another app we were working on, and I got pretty deep into collection view. I think I even bought a book only on collection view because it was pretty complicated, a lot more complicated than table view. And especially if you're going to do a custom collection view in the early days, there was a lot to learn. I remember going to some talks on collection view, and it kind of inspired me to put that in the other app. And
now, did you create the publication view as a series of table? No,
I think I did a collection view on that, but it was not a custom collection view. So for publication, it was really, well, it may have been scroll views only. I feel like there was a collection view on that, but it was just kind of a basic collection view. It wasn't a complicated one.
Yeah. So for people who don't understand what we're talking about, basically you run into a situation where you don't want to just scroll vertically. We had a publication section with magazines on a shelf, mm-hmm. kind of like Apple's Books app. And we wanted to have scrolling left to right and scrolling up and down. At least a collection view is what you have to have in order to do that. It allows for vertical scrolling and horizontal scrolling. And your books were different sizes. So you needed something that could maintain a book that was larger or smaller on the same shelf. Collection mm-hmm. view lets you do that. And then you were pointing out that now you really should just learn Swift UI, which is, you know, the more modern way, I should say, of developing user interface rather than UI Kit, which has been around for a long time with iOS development. But now Swift UI lets you build things much quicker. So they don't have table views. You just say, I need a list of items, and it automatically just creates it for you. That's pretty cool.
Well, and is table view, even if you're using UI Kit now, is it deprecated, or is it almost deprecated at this point?
It's not a thing in UI Kit because it's all declarative.
Well, no, I'm talking about even if you're using UI Kit these days, I'm not sure.
Table view, it's very much still there.
It's still there. Okay. I couldn't remember because there was talk that they were going to deprecate it at some point. I guess they never did.
Yeah. I think
they probably just create a Swift UI and.
I think they added some more features in the last couple of years to it.
Yeah, I just haven't paid attention to table view since we've gone all in on Swift UI.
Right.
The lazy V grids and H grids are cool too, because that's just the kind of the Swift UI way of doing collection view. I think it's pretty nice. You're going to run into, even now with Swift UI, you're going to run into a few limitations where you may have to go back to UI Kit and learn some UI Kit. But these days, I mean, I think most people are recommending that if you're new to iOS development, just start with Swift UI, and then you can always learn UI Kit along the way if you need to. But it's to the point now where, especially after this summer with another WWDC and advancements in Swift UI, you're probably going to be okay with just using Swift UI. Moving forward.
Okay, so let's talk about Facebook and their dilemma. Facebook is blaming Apple after a historically bad quarter, saying iPhone privacy changes will cost it $10 billion. And they're saying this because in 2021, Apple enabled users to choose which apps are allowed to track their behavior across apps. So as a result, the majority of users obviously opted out, especially considering the things that have happened with Facebook over the last few years in terms of privacy. And, you know, in my opinion, the terms of services have always been there. And yes, they move the goalposts a lot, and they like to take the approach of two steps forward and one step back just to keep moving people closer to what their ultimate goal is in terms of privacy. It's a slippery slope for Facebook. And I think they realize this, that people want more control of their privacy, and their whole business model is built on understanding and having insight of people's information. People didn't realize it because people just sign up because they want to see their friends, or they want to look at their, you know, family members, keep up with them, and they want to be involved socially online, and they want to see what other people's cats are doing. But for business, you know, there's an argument to be made that because they don't have that insight anymore, these businesses are paying Facebook to get the demographics they want, the information they want in front of the demographics that they want to market to. This is a major problem for Facebook. So they're saying, the impact of iOS overall as a headwind of our business in 2022 is over the order of $10 billion. And they can say this because basically in one day they lost, I'm trying to find the exact number so I don't get it wrong, but on the, I guess, Thursday morning after they did their earnings call, they basically said, you know, basically what we saw is that it dropped from as much as 25% from $323 per share to $245 on Thursday morning, effectively wiping out $230 billion in market value overnight.
Yep.
That's insane. That's more value than many companies ever even reach.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, I don't feel sorry for Facebook though, because they saw this coming. I mean, it's not like they weren't warned that this was going to happen. I mean, they were given like a year's notice and they did nothing about it other than complain and try to change, you know, it from happening and, you know, just go after Apple. And instead they could have been pivoting. They could have thought of another solution. And instead they just decided to go the route of, well, okay, we're going to have a war with Apple basically.
Well, I guess the issue is Apple has such a tight control over the way they handle advertising. They don't really have an option. And it's almost like, in my mind, it reminds me of AOL back in the day. AOL built their entire business on dial-up. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, broadband came out, like all of a sudden, their entire business model was completely obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think this is the reason why also, you know, there are other reasons, obvious reasons why Facebook decided to change their name.
Yeah.
But they are going all in and spending billions of dollars on the metaverse, a conversation for another podcast. But they're going all in that way because they know they're fighting a losing battle here.
Yeah.
If users are opting out of ad tracking and their information being accessible, there goes their whole business model of advertising, especially in terms of business. So, mm-hmm. you know, they know that, okay, we got to have to pivot quickly. And for them to throw billions of dollars into something completely different, it's almost like their social media network is second fiddle to them now. And I saw a recent article that said that Google's taking the same step. Now, mm-hmm. with Google, it's a little different because I think they're going to have to, obviously, Google makes their money on advertising, mm-hmm. but their model's different. They don't feel that Google will crack down as strenuous as Apple did because of their own. Now, I think that'll get Google in trouble if they block Facebook out, but then allow Google ads.
True.
So they're fighting their own battle, you know, in terms of trying to stay on the balancing scale with this issue. But Facebook mm-hmm. realizes this is a losing battle. People are being made aware of what's in the terms of services now. It's always been there. So, and people are making their choice. It's obvious people don't want to be tracked.
Yep.
Apple is definitely making, you know, they're marketing it for themselves. For Apple, that's a smart thing, but it's definitely making them more of an enemy going after privacy, but giving people what they want. I mean, ultimately the person decides whether or not they want this or not. If you want to have that insight given up or that privacy given up for the businesses, then you say, yeah, I don't mind. But, you know, most people are obviously the proof's here. People are opting mm-hmm. out.
Yeah. I think it's smart that Apple is doubling down on privacy. I think that they know that that's what their users want. So makes sense as a strategy for them too.
And finally, something cool. So we have an article about a couple in Georgia who becomes the first African-American owners of an autonomous grocery store. It's called Nourish and Bloom, founded by Jamie and Jalea Hemmings. And they decided to start the restaurant because their son was diagnosed with autism. So there were certain foods he needed to avoid in his autism. And so during the peak of the pandemic, they said, let's create a restaurant that will serve this purpose for people who have dietary restrictions because of their autism. And so their store has hands-free transactions. And I think Amazon was doing something like this where mm-hmm. their stores, you could walk in, pick up items and just walk out and you were charged upon walking out. So they're basically mm-hmm. taking the same concept here. They have cameras tracking movement throughout the store and their shelves are weighted to assist with the shopping experience. So I'm assuming like every shelf knows how heavy it's supposed to be and they have weights. So when you pick up something, it knows that it was removed. Cameras mm-hmm. are watching you. So it knows that you have the item. And one of the funny things in the video that's in the link, the guy said a lot of people were afraid to walk out because they thought they were stealing.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, I mean, but you know, cuss down, you don't have a line. That's pretty nice.
Yeah, you just pick up your item, nice, walk out the door.
Concept.
And so they have robots as well, and they can travel, it said, up to 3 miles for delivery. I mean, they're pretty small. Yeah. So I imagine it's just like emergency items. So
if you we were joking about, I think you maybe could get some sugar in there. And
instead of going to your neighbor's,
a sack of sugar, and that's about it.
My mama said, I need some flour and sugar instead of this is the new age version. And then, you know, that the robot shows up. It's kind of funny, but they've got these robots that could travel up to 3 miles, they say. And then what's interesting about this is they're not only creating the grocery store, they're teaming up with Microsoft and presenting STEM programs to Black communities.
Yeah, that's awesome.
They're also offering mentorship and training for Black adults as well. So they're a mission-focused organization as well. So they're trying to give back in their community and help people understand STEM and use this opportunity not only to, you know, help people during the pandemic to have hands-free transactions, but also to teach, hey, we can inspire Black children to say, they look like me and I can do that too. And I think that's a statement they made in the video, that they want to inspire young kids, again, breaking down the barriers so that people don't just assume there's a certain stereotype for STEM related fields.
Yeah, that's great.
One of my brothers and I had this idea that we should make a cyber restaurant. And it's funny because after the pandemic, you've seen more people open to the idea of ordering on an app.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more food delivery. And I was thinking, what if you had a very nice restaurant that you ordered and you not only order your food, you can pick your location so you can reserve the table. So when you get there, the food is perfectly timed because they know you're going to arrive, kind of like they do with Uber or any of the ride sharing apps. So it knows when you're on the way, so it can start to prepare based on the travel time. So it knows that you just, I'm on the way, and then people get there, and then, you know, you do have one waiter or waitress that will, because you want that personal experience, you can't completely remove that. So you still have cooks and you have a waiter and waitress, but you have maybe a little less people and you have a cyber restaurant where it's, you know, very technical. And I don't know, it was an idea we came up with. I think he was doing a college project and we brainstormed this, thought it would be cool. So this is what it reminded me of. Interesting to see where we're headed. People were forced, kicking and screaming, to go into the 21st century with the pandemic.
So I mean, it's like, you know, groceries now, I ordered something through Amazon or Whole Foods and on the app, and then drive up and they know, you know, they know when you left, they know when you're going to get there, and they're right there with your groceries. It's pretty cool, you don't even have to call or anything. So that's pretty nice. And then first time I saw a restaurant do something similar, or not even, I guess this was early days, but like Slotsky's Deli. I don't know if you remember, they used to have those computers, like those Macs. I think they were Emacs or something, that you would walk in and pull up the menu or whatever and order through the computer. So
I didn't know they were doing that.
Yeah, that was early. I mean, it was like in the 90s, I guess.
Well, Chili's, they've always had the little tablet on the table you can swipe your card on, and kids, and they're smart because they have those games that kids can pay money for.
Yeah.
And they're like, I want to play Candy Crush. It's like, that's on my phone. Why do you want to pay them?
Yeah. The Slotsky's Deli was pre-apps. I think that was even before the iPhone came out. They had the iMac. I think it was even, before the iPad.
They were ahead of their time, I guess.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, isn't McDonald's offering menus as you walk in now? Or is that every McDonald's? I think someone told me that they have menus now where you can just order right there and you don't have to have a cashier.
It could be, yeah. I don't know. I haven't been in McDonald's in forever.
I know. It's been a long time. The pricing of food has gone up so much that, you know, if I'm going to go out, I'm probably going out to a nicer restaurant. And I'm not, I have my few fast food restaurants that I go to, but I typically will go into a sit-down restaurant. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Swift App School podcast.
You can always find us online at swiftappschool.com, and we're also on social media at Swift App School on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Bye, y'all.
Goodbye.